The last case on our calendar is 03-922, State of Ohio versus Mark Canese. Justice Resnick has recused herself from this case. We're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Resnick, Judge Sheila Farmer, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals sitting in the 5th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Farmer.
Thank you.
Mr. Oster.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. My name is Michael Oster, and I, along with Mr. Stephen Carney from the Attorney General's Office, will be representing the State of Ohio in this matter. Your Honor, at this time, I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal.
Watch your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, the crux of the case at bar is the statutory interpretation of Section 2921.43C. The State contends that for three reasons, the lower court incorrectly interpreted this section. First, the lower court added an additional element into this section, which is not written. Second, the lower court failed to properly consider the context of the statute as a whole. And finally, the lower court interpreted this section in such a way as to yield an illogical result.
Counsel, before you get into your argument, there was no corresponding attempt to commit the crime prosecuted along with this?
No, Your Honor.
And no ability or no charge on attempt, I think.
Your Honor, in the statute, attempt is not listed. One of the main reasons that would most likely not be listed, Your Honor, is because in sections A and B, it goes towards solicitation. In solicitation, there normally cannot be an attempt towards solicitation as it is its own crime. Therefore, the actual attempt in this matter was not written into the statute and therefore was not put forth when originally prosecuted in this case, Your Honor. Your Honors, the section of the statute that is most relevant that the 12th District focused on was the statement, coerce any contribution. However, when the 12th District was to look at that, they looked at it and said to coerce any contribution meant you had to obtain or receive that contribution. However, the words obtain and receive are nowhere to be found in Section C of that statute. The 12th District read an additional element into that statute, Your Honors. This court has said that it will not read into a statute additional language that is not present.
Okay. What is a contribution?
Contribution, the statute states any contribution. That contribution could be monetarily, it could be more time, more effort.
Okay,
it merely states.
How do you define a contribution?
Your Honor, the state would define a contribution as anything that would go toward giving a greater means toward the party as it is written in Section C. Greater means would be monetarily a greater mean, more
work.
A
payment of money or delivery of goods or services.
Yes, Your Honor.
That'd be a fair statement.
Yes, Your Honor. That would be what the contribution was. However, the contribution in this case is modified by the term coerce. That is where the real crux of this case is to whether the word coerce inclines that something must be actually given, or whether coerce in and of itself is the act of uttering words to trying to get someone to give that contribution. Here, Your Honors, the 12th District made it so that it had to be obtained or received, but those words are nowhere in the statute. This court has stated that it would not put upon prosecutors and courts an additional burden or duty if it is not plainly written in the statute. To hold under the 12th District's ruling would be to put an additional burden or an additional element into the statute, and this court has stated that it will not do so. Second, Your Honors, in the context of this statute as a whole, it is relevant that the 12th District did say that it would look at the context and construe it according to the rules of grammar and common usage. However, the 12th District then abandoned the context and went straight to using a dictionary definition in this case. Your Honors, it is imperative that the court look toward the context of this definition. That is because statute upon the same or similar subject matter should be read in pari materiale to each other. In a brief overview in dissecting this statute from the beginning, although the title is not conclusive, the title does state is solicitation or receiving improper compensation. It is important to say that it uses the word or. Further, in both sections A and B of this statute, the legislature used the word or. It said solicitation or acceptance. It never required both in either of those subsections. And then going below Section C into Section D, it says, whoever violates that section is guilty of soliciting. And it's important to note that Section D is a reflection upon all those sections, Sections A, B, and C. Therefore, the intent in this case and the context that Section C must be read under states that it is solicitation or acceptance and not both. Therefore, Your Honors, by reading in that both were necessary, the 12th District again violated the cardinal rule of reading it within the context, and in doing so, they added the additional element which is not there. Further, Your Honors, when it goes into the dictionary definition, the lower court again erred when it used this dictionary definition. This court has stated that a dictionary definition can be used as a starting point, but not as a finishing point. Here, the lower court used it as the finishing point. It defined coerce, and it defined compel, and it said, well, by those two definitions, we have enough for a holding. However, when the General Assembly's intent is contrary to the meaning that is found, it is the General Assembly's intent that must be looked at. That is because the General Assembly's intent is the paramount concern of a court when they are doing statutory interpretation. Here, Your Honors, as discussed by dissecting the statute, the paramount concern was that a solicitation or acceptance took place, not both. Further, Your Honors, in viewing sections that have defined the term coerce by the General Assembly, one is found in a criminal context under section 2905.12, the other in a civil context under section 4517.01cc. It is important to note that when the legislature in both a criminal and civil environment had the chance to define this term, in the criminal, they define it as to take, withhold, or threaten to take or withhold action. And in the civil, they defined it as to compel or attempt to compel something to happen. Therefore, Your Honors, it is clear that when the legislature uses the term coerce, it means not only does something actually have to be obtained, it means that what is to be prevented is the attempt to do something or the threat to make somebody else do something. That is how the General Assembly means to use that word coerce. Further, when the 12th District got a dictionary definition, it merely grabbed a dictionary definition from a Webster's dictionary. However, this court has stated that when getting a dictionary definition, you must look to the most appropriate definition in the context of a statute.
Well, and which I'm still having trouble with which definition did they seize on or define improperly. My reading of what the Court of Appeals did, it seemed that they looked at subsection A, which talks about soliciting, and C, which doesn't use the word soliciting, instead says coerce a contribution. And they said since nothing happened in terms of the person, the victim of this coercion didn't perform, you don't have a statutory violation.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. Firstly, it is not imperative that the victim here have to take an affirmative action in this case.
Okay, well, what definition did they get wrong?
Your Honor, the definition they got wrong were both the definition of coerce and the definition of compel. In getting those wrong, they did so for multiple reasons. First, they failed to adequately look to the context, and they also failed to look at what the General Assembly means when it uses the term coerce. Further, when they did use a dictionary definition, they did not use the one that is the most appropriate in this context. If they did, they would have looked at other definitions which would have used the terms as the General Assembly has used multiple times to include the threat of or the attempt to compel. In the dictionary definition that the visiting 12th District included, it made no mention of that. It made no mention of having to look at the actual context of the statute in that regard, Your Honor. In doing so, not only did they violate those canons, but they would violate section 1.47C, which states that in enacting a statute, it is presumed that a just and reasonable result is intended. In this case, the criminal actor intended for a contribution to be made. He uttered the words that he hoped would coerce someone into making it. It is illogical to say that the victim themselves must then give into that coercion and not merely go report a crime to the authorities. To say so would to be say that if Mr. Dixon here, the criminal, didn't go to tell the authorities but was merely fired, he would have no recourse. That would mean that the criminal actor in this case would be able to get away with threatening someone, and if that person didn't acquiesce to the threat, he could fire them and there would be no recourse along this statute. That would be an illogical result. The legislature could not have intended that. The legislature wrote this statute with the purpose of trying to protect people from the pressures of political bosses. The legislature could not have meant for that to be the end result. And the only way that end result was reached was by the 12th District inserting words that are plainly not in the statute, Your Honors. Your Honors, at this time, as
Well, you admit there was coercion, correct?
I'm sorry,
Your Honor? You think there was coercion?
Yes, Your Honor, there was coercion. There was at least the threat or the attempt to compel someone into doing something, and that is how the General Assembly has defined coercion in both a civil and criminal context.
What was the contribution?
That to coerce would be to threaten or attempt to compel the contribution. The contribution is modified by the term coercion. The coercion is the verb, the contribution is the noun, something to be sought to obtain. So he threatened or attempted to obtain that merely because the victim did not want to give in to that coercion does not take away the fact that the coercion was the act that the criminal actor must have done. Here, the words he uttered, "We will fire you. You'll probably lose your job," things of that nature. Those are the coercive action that the General Assembly meant to protect the victim from in this case, Your Honors, as seen when they define the term coerce.
Thank you.
So basically, the activity there takes the requested, the activity by the defendant takes the requested voluntariness out of the act of the witness and makes it a coercive act. Or the potential to be, if the act is not completed, as it was not done here, but you're saying that the defendant's activity makes this a non-voluntary, which is important.
Your Honor, the defendant's activity does complete this crime. The crime has three elements. There must be coercion by a person for the benefit of a political party, and then that must then reflect in consideration of something. In this case, what the victim does or does not do has no bearing upon the criminal action. It is easily compared to an inchoate crime, where the actus reus is the act of uttering the words. The mens rea is wanting to compel someone to do something. It would be illogical to say that the victim, in this case, must take an affirmative action to allow for Mr. Canisa's activity to be considered a crime. Further, that action of giving money to the party might have well opened up that victim to a crime themselves. So not only is it a possibility that you would be asking for the victim to make a definitive action, but that definitive action may have to be a criminal action, and that person would have to do both a voluntary action and possibly a criminal action before Mr. Canisa could even be considered to be a criminal under the way the 12th District defined the statute. That is an illogical result.
And shouldn't the definitive act, the definitive evidence be the feeling that the victim had as far as coercion worked upon him? And if there's, I mean, they're in the best position to determine whether or not they were coerced.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would say that this victim felt that they were coerced. This victim, in getting a call saying that two heads of the party wanted to meet with them, felt that this was strange, that this was an unusual situation, so they felt the need to bring a tape recorder. As well, they felt the need that they had no choice, that they must leave the party. That person had to do that. They were forced into leaving and doing something because of all the coercive activities that they felt. The mere threat that having to put someone through that situation would be enough in this case, and it was supplied by the victim and what the victim has testified to and what evidence was proven in the case. Your Honors, as we are running low in time now, if there are no further questions, I'd ask for the remainder of the time to reserve for the Attorney General upon rebuttal.
Okay, there's about a minute.
Yes.
Okay, so he'll take rebuttal. He'll take Mr. Carney. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Oster. Mr. Canisa.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. In this case, it's important to note that the trial court granted Rule 29 motion for acquittal after the the jury could not reach a verdict. That the section was 359916F, which relied on 351709B. The section the acquittal was directed on said that no person shall threaten to coerce, an easier case to prove than the one the conviction was rendered on at trial court. In this court's ruling on the State versus Taylor, Justice O'Connor, concurring opinion, said basically that there is a gap in statutory language and it is solely within the General Assembly's purview to close it. If there is a gap in this case as to 292143C, the legislature, the General Assembly needs to close it. The legislature saw fit to put threaten to coerce in a statute and saw fit in 292143A and B to talk about soliciting being the standard, not coercing any contribution.
Counsel, how do you threaten to coerce? Isn't that an oxymoron of sort?
No, I don't think so. But the General Assembly wrote it that way. So that would be an easier standard. If coercion is not required, but threatening to coerce a contribution.
Well, I mean, you either coerce or you don't coerce.
Right. Well, in this case, I did not, as the defendant appellee, did not coerce. Mr. Dixon's never testified at trial that he was coerced, intimidated, threatened, or afraid. Only stated that he was insulted by the request. He was never said, you'll probably be fired. He was never told that that I would fire him. In fact, there's evidence that he never resigned his position. He continued in his employment throughout. Contrary to the Attorney General's brief, where they say he resigned his position with the Attorney General's, his own testimony and my testimony shows that he continually was employed by the Butler County Board of Elections. It's very important.
Did he stay as the Democratic appointee, or was he switched to being the Republican appointee?
On the primary in March, in that it was a presidential year, he switched his party designation. He continued uninterrupted his employment. He became a Republican employee. There was a vacancy. It was never filled. There was never a vote of the Board of Election. He continues to this day. He's never been interrupted in his employment.
But he is the Republican designee then, yes or no?
There are two Republican designees at this time. At the time of the incident on March 1st, there was one Democrat and one Republican. Now there are two Democrats and two Republicans. Two positions had been created by his father, the then member of the Board of Elections, and those positions were in the waiting. He switched parties and continued in his employment with no further votes of the Board of Election.
Do we know why he switched parties?
He says at the trial it's because the way I asked for this contribution.
So he could keep his position on the board. Apparently.
Excuse me, Justice.
So he could keep his position on the board.
Are you talking about his father or the?
No, him.
Brent Dixon.
Dixon.
Changed parties, but never signed a resignation, never asked to resign, never asked to give up his position, and continued as a special assistant. His father, Don Dixon, who had hired him as a Democrat, also switched parties with him at the primary. Why they switched parties, they give an explanation at trial. Whether it's believed or not is subject to whoever reads it.
Counsel?
Yes.
An official of a political party said to deputy registrar, you need to give 50 cents to the party for every license plate you sell, or we're going to find a replacement for you. And that deputy registrar said, I'm not doing it, and then was replaced. No contribution takes place, but a replacement in direct sequence after being told either give or get out, or we're going to get you out. Is that a violation of this statute?
It might be. It depends on how the evidence would play out at trial. If, in fact, he was he or she was coerced. The court below, the appellate court,
so the contribution is not, or the lack thereof, is not essential or critical to whether or not there's a violation.
It is in this section. If the prosecution charges the wrong section, that's their problem. It's not this court's problem.
Well, I'm asking under this section, under that fact scenario.
Under this section, the state has to prove a contribution, a coercion of any contribution. They're not read separately, they're read together. The court below did not find there was coercion, did not find there was a contribution. It looked for coercion of any contribution. Okay.
Let me put to you the hypothetical so we can get at the critical nature of whether or not there's a contribution. There is a direct, flat out, coercive conversation from someone in a position to enforce it, saying you either give or you're going to lose your position here as a deputy registrar, for example, and you give this much, and the person said, I'm not doing it, and boom, they're removed and someone else is appointed.
Justice Pfeiffer,
violation of this subsection C, is that
correct? That might very well be a violation of sub A and B or other sections of law, including.
Well, it doesn't seem to fit A or B, does it?
Or under 3599.16F as it applies to 3517.09B, which is what the other charge was, but it most definitely does not apply to C. A contribution has to be shown. And if the legislature drafted this improperly, and if they need to cover a new class of potential victims, they need to change the wording of the statute. But as the statute is worded, there's no application to this case, and the Court of Appeals correctly found that it did not apply. It's further well established that the state cannot add or subtract words to try to make sense of a statute. The statute stands on its face. This subsection has a clear and definite meaning. The Court of Appeals used the appropriate dictionary definition, and it applied the law correctly. The testimony is clear that Mr. Dixon was insulted, not coerced. When asked again by the prosecutor about how it made him feel, he could not say it made him he felt coerced or threatened. He was insulted that someone would ask him after all these years.
Well, one could, you would, I assume, agree that a jury could properly find coercion where the victim never used the word coerced in their testimony. That's a big word to some folks.
Right, but he doesn't say anything synonymous with that, such as intimidated or threatened or afraid or scared. He says insulted, which is not paramount to coerced. He makes it clear that he was pretty indignant. He said, I'm still insulted at trial today, some 2 years later. Now, this 4 years later, the fact of the matter is he was not coerced to be there. He was never told, as the prosecution says, that you will probably lose your job. There was discussions of possibly losing his job out of his own mouth. Okay, no one can make a guarantee in life what your budgetary restraints will be and how long anyone's staff will be here. Possibility is not the magic word here. What the state does and the Attorney General's office tries to do is take a statute that's clearly worded and disregard State versus Taylor. In that case, sexual predator statute, the wording, they argued in that case, as they're arguing here, the state and the prosecution, that if you don't do this, there's going to be people hurt. No, there's not. The legislature can change this, or a prosecutor can charge a more appropriate section and prove something easier to prove. But in this case, the easier section, acquittal, was directed. And there was a lack of evidence to prove the 292143C. The alleged victim here was not an alleged victim. He chose the meeting place and time and chose to have it before the primary so that he could change parties. His father had created a position for him to go to so that he could change parties. And to say he's a victim isn't appropriate. But the General Assembly should do their job and change this section if the prosecution wants to be able to deal with this in the future. My brief stands on itself. The Court of Appeals wrote an excellent decision.
Let me ask you a direct question, counsel.
Yes,
does the evidence reflect that you ask him to contribute 100% of his net pay to the party in return for this public position that he held?
There's no quid pro quo. I do a point on the tape, asked him to increase his contribution. Net pay is a relative term. I don't know his tax bracket. I think I asked him to contribute $400 a month instead of $200 as I was contributing all my after-tax dollars. I don't know what his bracket is, but I did ask him to increase his contribution. But I never said, if you don't do this, you will be fired. I asked him to become more involved in the party. Both of these I'm permitted to do under the First Amendment and under our system, party leaders do. I asked him for many things to participate in. And I asked him an alternative of giving more if he would consider other things, other ideas that we might do. If he can't, and I also, more importantly, said, if you don't want to do this, think about it. We'll get together later. You may not think this is fair. The whole reading shows that he was not being coerced. If anything, he was controlling the conversation.
Was there the possibility that he would lose his job? Did you use that word possibility?
He used the word possibility. Someone else in the meeting used the word possibility. And I said possibility with my hands at like this with a question mark. As in, I can't guarantee your job will be always be here. That's not the point that was being made. I didn't bring up losing his job. He brought it up. And he was speaking of, hypothetically, a different person. If these new persons are hired and they don't contribute, is there a possibility they could lose their job? Anything's possible. And again, the commission can cut the Board of Elections budget and be in a position where you can't afford to keep.
Added two positions.
Excuse me?
You added two more special positions. He was not in the position of losing his job.
That's incorrect. His father, the prior board, before I was a member, voted to create these positions. And our county commission takes funds back as quick as they give them, within 6 months or a year very often. So there's always a possibility. These positions of special assistance, excuse me, if I may get a glass of water.
Sure.
These positions of the special assistants are people who work basically 2 weeks a year, get $6,000 PERS and health coverage, and do very little work for that. They are not the day-to-day persons. In all honesty, politically, these two additional special assistant positions should have never been created. They were created so both parties would have another person to hire. From an economic point of view, from a budgetary point of view, they should have never been created. I wasn't on the board when they were created. And I could see very much where the county commission, when facing future budget crunches, would come back and cut both or all, two of the four or all four of the budgetary of the special assistant positions.
Could I ask one question? The genesis of the Court of Appeals decision is on a manifest weight of the evidence assignment of error, is that right?
Yes, okay. Your Honor. There's no further questions. I thank the court for its time. I appreciate the job you do, and it's never easy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Canese. Mr. Kearney, you have a minute for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. As amicus, Attorney General Jim Petro urges the court to find that the harm in this statute is the pressure itself, and coercion is complete as soon as the pressure is placed. And there are two main reasons I'd like to briefly, if I may, focus on. First is, if you look at A and B and compare it to C, the answer to why we say coercion instead of solicit or accept, the answer to that is in letter F. Letter F, which we haven't talked about yet, says that nothing here prohibits a voluntary contribution to a political party. And what that shows is in A and B, the asking alone is the harm. A and B are about getting money for your personal pocket, to line your pocket. And in those, just asking is wrong. With C, though, we want to balance. We want to allow truly voluntary ones, but not allow people to push involuntary contributions. So the gravamen, the essence, is not whether the money changes hands, but whether pressure is placed. And so the Court of Appeals was onto something but got it wrong. What makes coercion different from A and B is not what the other person does in sending the money across the table from that side of the transaction. It's that it's solicitation plus pressure. And that extra oomph is what makes C different from A and B. Yes, coercion requires an extra element of pressure, but it does not require the full consummation of receiving money. Were that the case, then as Justice Pfeiffer mentioned, you could actually be fired, anything could happen, put a gun to someone's head, burn down their house, and as long as you still don't get the money, you're still fine. And that is wrong as a matter of what this statute means and what the law should uphold, because that would gut not only some prosecutions, but virtually all prosecutions, because victims are not going to go along. You're never going to get prosecutions, or they're not going to report it if they thought they went along with something wrong.
You've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.